Translation. O Mother Devaki, by your good fortune and ours, the Supreme Personality of Godhead himself, with all his plenary portions, such as Baladev, is now within your womb. Therefore, you need not fear Kamsa, who has decided to be killed by the Lord. Your eternal son Krishna will be the protector of the entire Yadu dynasty. Purport. The words Parapuman Amshena signify that Krishna is the original Supreme Personality of Godhead. This is the verdict of the Shastra, Krishna's Tu Bhagavan Swayam. Thus the demigods assured Devaki, your son is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and he is appearing with Baladev, his plenary portion. He will give you all protection and kill Kamsa, who has decided to continue his enmity towards the Lord and thus be killed by him. Amagyana Timrindasya Gananjana Shalakya Chakshur Umilitamina Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha. Namom Vishnu Padaya Krishna Upstai Bhutale Srimate Hridayananda Goswami Nita Namane. Namom Vishnu Padaya Krishna Upstai Bhutale Srimate Shibaram Swami Nita Namane. Namom Vishnu Padaya Krishna Upstai Bhutale Srimate Bhaktivedanta Swami Nita Namane. Namaste Sarasvati Devi Gauravani Pracharane Nirvishesha Shunyavari Pashkacha Deshtarane. Mukham karoti vachalam pangam langayate girim yat kripata maham vande shri gurundina taranam vande shri krishna chaitanya nityananda sahodito gaurudai pushpanvanto chitra shando tamonado. I offer my humble obeisances unto Lord Chaitanya and Lord Nityananda, who have arisen over the horizon of Gaudadesh, just like the sun and the moon, to dissipate the darkness of ignorance and to wonderfully bestow benediction upon all. Narayanam namaskrita naram chaiva narottamam devim sarasvatim vyasam tato jayamudirayat nashta prayashu badrashu nityam bhagavata seviya bhagavati irtam shloke bhakti bhavati naishtiki. Dishtyambate kukshigata parapuman amshena sakshad bhagavan bhavayana ma buddhbayam boja patema mushur gupta yodunam bhavita tavatmaja. The setting is that Krishna has entered the womb of Devaki and she's very effulgent, especially since she's in the prison of Kamsa. It's a dark environment, so her effulgence is all the more accentuated. And the demigods have noticed this, so the demigods have come to offer these prayers. And this is one of those prayers. And in this prayer, there's this very intriguing phrase where it says that you need not fear Kamsa, who has decided to be killed by the Lord. So, it seems to say that he's chosen to be killed by Kamsa. So, if you was to ask him directly, would you like to be, sorry, he's been chosen to be killed by Krishna. So if you was to approach Kamsa and say, would you like to be killed by Krishna? He wouldn't say yes. Certainly he wouldn't say yes. That's exactly opposite of what he'd say. But it's saying here that he's chosen to be killed. He's made this choice. The word, you know, choice or chosen means he's selected this from available options. But why is it saying this when it's really the fact of the matter is the opposite? Why is it saying that he's chosen to be killed? Essentially, this brings up the subject of the law of karma and how karma works. And it's the whole subject, really, of free will and destiny as well. Kamsa has behaved in a certain way that has made it inevitable and inescapable that he be killed by Krishna. So his behavior is tantamount to choosing to be killed. That's the point. It's the equivalent of choosing to be killed. It's the same as. This law of karma is there to maintain the balance of nature. We have that verse, Om Purnam Adha Purnam Idam Purnat Purnam Udachite. Very beautiful verse. And it's saying that everything is perfect and complete. Everything's a complete balance. So the law of karma is there to maintain the complete balance. And as soon as something is out of balance, then the law of karma comes to act in a compensatory way to return things to their balance. So somebody might say, well, look at the material world. It's completely chaotic. It's completely, it's pandemonium. How can you say there's a balance? There isn't a balance at the moment because of so much misuse of free will. But the law of karma is incessantly bringing things back into that balance. And why is this? It's because in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, Samoham sarva bhuteshu name dveshtisti na priyaha. The reason why is because Krishna says, I'm equal to all. I'm not partial to anyone. I'm not envious of anyone. I'm equal to all. So Krishna wants to give everybody an equal opportunity to fulfill their desires, whether the desires are whether the desires are noble or ignoble doesn't make any difference. Krishna is giving everyone an equal opportunity to fulfill their desires. So if one living entity is exploiting another living entity in order to fulfill their desire, then the law of karma creates this reaction to teach them a lesson. You can't treat another living entity like that. They've got just as much right as you have to fulfill their desires. So therefore, you have to receive this karmic reaction. There was a song in the 60s. I'm sure Jayadev remembers this. Bob Dylan. He wrote that song, Like a Rolling Stone. And there's a part in that song where he says, how does it feel? How does it feel? So when somebody exploits another living entity, Krishna's basically trying to instill in them the sensitivity to find out and to experience how does it feel. You've exploited this other living entity. You've brought upon them some... you've disturbed them, you've upset them, you've offended them. So now you have to find out how it feels. And that's what the law of karma does. In the story of Dhruva Maharaj, there's this beautiful passage where his mother, Suniti, is giving him advice. Because he has got, there's this whole vengefulness has been summoned up in him because his father showed partiality to his stepbrother because of his attachment to his favorite wife. And Dhruva Maharaj is seething and he's talking to his mother and she says to him, Mamangala tata paresha mamsta bungte janayat paraduka das tat. She said, don't wish anything inauspicious upon another living entity. Do not wish anything inauspicious upon another because he who harms another living entity must suffer themselves from that same pain. If you harm another living entity, you will have to experience the same pain that you caused in that other living entity. This is how the law of karma works. And the law of karma doesn't, like another song by Neil Young, he wrote a song called Rust Never Sleeps. So the law of karma never sleeps. There's never a period where the law of karma is away on leave. It's always there, ever vigilant. And it's so precise because this is Krishna's energy. And Krishna's omniscient, omnipotent. And so this law of karma does not miss out on even the slightest detail. It's actually creating this balance to the finest detail. It's interesting also that we see how, if we look back in, I heard this in a class by Suhotra Swami, if we look back in the previous life of Dhruva Maharaj, he was a Brahmin in the court of a king. And what happened was that what started to well up in him was this desire to experience the opulences of a king, to actually experience what it feels like to have so much power and influence and opulence. And so in the class Suhotra Swami gave, he said, therefore we can understand how Dhruva Maharaj wanted to have a kingdom beyond even that of his grandfather, because the seeds of that ambition were passed on to his next life. This is something I once read Carl Jung, a famous psychologist. He once coined this phrase that the seeds of hereditary ambition are passed on through successive generations until fulfillment. So he's saying that you know, whatever your parents desired, you know, you took birth from them because you had consonant desires. So if they didn't fulfill their desires, they passed them on to you. And then if you don't fulfill yours, you'll pass them on to your children, and then it'll keep going until those desires are fulfilled. There's something in that, but it's not entirely, it needs to be very much qualified. But one thing we can say is that our own unfulfilled desires from a previous life carry over into the next life. That much we can say. Yam yam vapi smaram bhavam tyajit yante kleveram tam tamevaiti kontiya sadatad bhava bhavitaha. So that's there in the Bhagavad Gita. Whatever state of mind a person has at the time when they're leaving their body, that is the state they will attain in the next life. And of course, the state of mind we have at the time of death is determined by how we behave in this life. It's determined by how we use our free will. And every time we use our free will, every single time, again down to the finest detail, there is a consequence, there is a reaction. Krishna's created this law. It's actually a law that cannot be broken. In the Bhagavatam, the law is stated, Saiva Ivedam Sasajagre. Ivedam Sasajagre. Sasaja means creation. Agri means at the beginning. At the beginning of the material creation, Bhagavan Atma Maya, Krishna, in his transcendental position, Sadasad Rupayachasho, he creates the laws of cause and effect. Guna Maya Guno Vibhu. Vibhu means like with his unlimited power. And from his position, from Krishna's position of being transcendental to the material nature, he's created these laws of cause and effect. Krishna's in a transcendental position, so he's created these laws of cause and effect. We see these laws of cause and effect working, I see them working very vividly in the sections of the Bhagavad Gita which describe the modes of material nature. So if you act in the mode of ignorance, then there's a certain result. If you act in the mode of passion, there's a certain result. And if you act in the mode of goodness, there's a certain result. And if you act transcendentally, there's a certain result. So it's really, this is the stuff of philosophy, really, that you can actually see these relationships and these patterns and these kind of formulas, if you like, that if you behave like this and if you behave like this, then you're going to get this result. So it's not a coincidence that many great philosophers were great mathematicians, because this is how mathematics also works. You know, mathematics is that, you know, this amount plus this amount equals this amount. So in the Bhagavad Gita, it says this is important, that if you're in the human form of life, that you exercise yourself in this way. You exercise your consciousness, your intelligence, to actually come to understand what is the truth. Because 2 + 2 = 5 is not the truth. And you can show somebody that that's not the truth. Most people you can show that's not the truth. Because I remember once in Cambridge, I was talking to this, he was an Indian chap who was doing some doctorate in mathematics, and he said there's some kind of mathematics where 2 + 2 does not equal 4. I said, okay, so that's just some esoteric thing, let's not bother about that, let's just talk about the real world. And he said, this is real. So I said to him, well, I said to him, how many legs does a cow have at the front? And he said, 2. I said, how many does he have at the back? And he said, 2. And I said, how many does he have altogether? And he says, oh, no. So, you know, we're not talking about that, but we're talking about just the, you know, with everything being equal, then we have these mathematical relationships, and philosophy and mathematics is not disconnected. So, for instance, in the Bhagavad Gita, there's the verse, Yad tad agre vishameva pariname mritopamam tatsukam satvikam proktam atma buddhi prasadajam. It's saying that things can start in the beginning. They can begin, like for instance, if you're starting off following 4 regulative principles, chanting 16 rounds, it's like an austerity. It's difficult. Yat tad agre vishameva pariname mritopamam. But eventually, when we start to, as it also says in the Gita, taste the nectar of the fruits of sacrifice, when you start to taste the nectar of those fruits of sacrifice, when you're performing yajna to Krishna and you're tasting some of that nectar, then pariname means at the end, it tastes like nectar. So you can see how the sequence works. Tatsukam, that happiness, satvikam, is in the mode of goodness. Atma buddhi prasadajam, and it awakens one to self-realization. Also, that line is very significant, really, because it awakens one to self-realization. Self-realization means to be happy. So this is talking about happiness in the mode of goodness. It starts to awaken one to their constitutional position of ananda, satchitananda. So in the Gita, there's Bhagavad Gita, that the verse that explains the importance of this is the last verse of that sequence which explains the items of knowledge. And the last verse of that sequence states, adhyatma jnana nityatvam tatva jnanartha darshanam, tattva gyanartha darshanam. It's to understand the importance of self-realization. And the other one is that a human being philosophically search for the absolute truth. These are items of knowledge, to philosophically search for the absolute truth. So philosophically searching for the absolute truth means that you're undergoing this exercise of examining the validity of different statements and of different claims. And so when you can establish that, yes, this is true, and this is true. So let's put the two truths together and see what else we have. Let's push the frontier back a little bit. So this is the work of philosophy. This is how philosophy is meant to work. It's like you should be able to, if you're really taking things on, you should be able to dismantle something to its little component parts, examine those component parts. Are there any of them invalid, or are they all valid? If they're all valid, let's put them back together. This dismantling and reassembling. And we're not, in mathematics, we're talking about numbers and units and, what is it when you use X and Y? That's called algebra, yeah. You're using these terms, but in philosophy, you're using metaphysical terms. And we need to actually learn how to do the same thing with metaphysical terms and come to conclusions, higher and higher conclusions, ultimately the conclusion of the absolute truth, which is Krishna. So this is like logic and reason, and we're coming to the conclusion that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And what's interesting is in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, Shri Shri Radha Gokula Nanda Ki Jai, Sitaram Lakshman Hanuman Ki Jai, Shri Shri Gaura Nitai Ki Jai, Iskanga Guru Vrinda Ki Jai. In the Chaitanya Charitamrita, there's one section where I think it's Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami says that if you put the mercy of Lord Chaitanya to the test of logic, you will find that it possesses the highest logic available. I can't remember it exactly. Can you remember, Govinda? How does that work? Yeah, thank you very much. That's nice. You will be amazed at just how efficacious Lord Chaitanya's mercy is if you're just approaching it with logic. So what's intriguing or what's fascinating, even tantalizing you could say, is that Lord Chaitanya's mercy goes beyond logic. It's actually beyond logic because it's transcendental. The logic of the absolute truth is that it's beyond logic. So when we're trying to preach to conditioned souls, they're using their sort of powers of reason, which are material, and so they cannot really approach Krishna as long as they hold on to their this material equipment. They're trying to find Krishna with material equipment and material means, and it's not possible. The mercy of Lord Chaitanya is not possible. It's not possible to actually apprehend by logic or by laws of material cause and effect. But they can take you to, as they say, they can take you to the airport. And then when you get to the airport, you just have to surrender, because ultimately Lord Chaitanya's mercy is attained by surrendering. It's not by any intellectual power of logic or reasoning. So that's some of the thoughts I have on this class and on this very, very interesting notion that Kamsa has chosen to be killed. So are there any comments or questions?